show is dedicated to all those POWs and MIAs from all of America's wars who are still unaccounted for. Always remember, you are not forgotten.
From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Dale Thronberry.
And good morning, America, and welcome to Veterans Radio. We are so excited to have you here this morning, coming to you from the studios of WDEO 990 AM in Ann Arbor, Michigan. We've got a great program lined up for you. Running my board today is the Air Boss, Bob Gould.
Hello out there, everybody.
Good morning, Robert.
The last one to call me, that was my mom. And you know what? I don't have anybody to replace her, and I'm not looking now. There you go.
All right. Anyway, we've got a great program going on this morning. We're going to be talking with an author, Joe Carvalho, whose book is We Were Beautiful Once, and it's a story about Korea, POWs, MIAs, based on a true experience that he actually had as a lawyer, so I'm excited to have that. In the second half of the program, we're going to have the program manager here at WDEO, Mike Jones, and his son, the new second lieutenant, Michael P. Jones, Jr., I believe, Air Force Academy. So we're going to be very excited to have that happen later on in the program. One event that I need to talk about that's coming up here in the local area, and that is Thunder Over Michigan. And Thunder Over Michigan is coming up on August 10th and 11th. It's going to be at the Willow Run Airport here in Ypsilanti, Michigan. If you like airplanes, you like helicopters, you like anything that has to do with air,
it's
going to be quite exciting. They've got all kinds of different aircraft. I can't even name them all. They've got AC-47 gunships, A-1 Sky Raiders, F-100 Super Sabres.
Helicopters.
UH-1 Hueys,
yeah,
H models.
There you go.
The cool ones. The ones that I got to, had the honor of flying around, and I'm hoping to get involved in that. There's going to be a World War II battle reenactment. There's going to be a helicopter assault from the Vietnam era reenactment. So a couple of things that you need to know is that kids under 15 are get in for free.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I bet you see. And if you go and order tickets online right now, you get them at a discount. So
hey, what a deal. It is a destination spot.
Oh, yeah. It's a great program, and there are going to be all kinds of demonstrations. As I said, there are static displays of a wide variety of aircraft for those of you that are fascinated by airplanes like many of us here are. So go to the website for the YankeeAirMuseum.org.
And yeah, be sure it's .org.
It is a .org.
I know you're saying that, but because I got fooled. We're so used to doing .com,
yeah,
and .net.
True. That is true. But this is a great time. August 10th and 11th, Willow Run Airport, Ypsilanti, Michigan. Don't miss this. This is a great opportunity. All right, Robert, that's it for announcements for today. We're going to go to our first break and come back with our author, Joe Carvalho. We'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Mr. Sandman, bring me a dream. Make him the cutest that I've ever seen.
All right, so now all of us have time-tripped back to the 1950s, early 1950s. I don't know about you, but I can remember hearing that music when I was but a mere child. maybe 4 or 5 years old. But I do also remember the Korean War was something that really affected a lot of people in America. I don't know how many people were paying attention, but realize that this was only 4 or 5 years after the end of World War II. And here we are, we're back into another conflict. And so today on our program, our guest is author Joe Carvalho, and he is an American writer, lawyer, and veteran born in Connecticut. His novel that we're going to talk about today is We Were Beautiful Once, Chapters from a Cold War. And this was inspired by an actual case that he tried in federal court to try and locate a Korean War POW. Joe, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Dale.
It's a real privilege to talk to you, Joe. I'm so grateful that you sent me this book. For those of you that are interested in the POW-MIA issue, this is something you really need to read. It's even though it's a fictionalized story, it really does grip you, and it's based on facts. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. Well, largely locating the POW and the court case that's portrayed in the novel itself actually took place. Essentially what an author does in a novel is he needs to populate it, of course, with characters of some fiction and, create a story around actual events. What I try to do, is to be historically accurate. And in that way, the Korean War as it's characterized is pretty accurate in terms of the battles that I write about and how the people ended up getting into the situation they got themselves into, and insofar as POWs were concerned, where they were encamped in Camp 5. I called it Camp 13, I think, in the book. Mm-hmm. But it was up on the Yalu River. That's a pretty accurate characterization of their life for the better part of 3 years for a lot of them. And then sometime later, trying to locate one of them that the government persisted in claiming had been lost. And that becomes the central focus of the novel itself.
So tell me about this case that you had of trying to locate a POW in Korea, because I found that part to be really, really fascinating to me.
Well, when the... when the armistice was signed, and incidentally, there's a couple of coincidences going on here as we speak. The armistice was basically agreed to 30 years ago yesterday and signed essentially 1 week later. So we're right on the anniversary, the 60th anniversary of the armistice. We're also 30 years and one day from the court case where, I walked into a federal district court up in Hartford, Connecticut, essentially suing the Secretary of Defense and the President of the United States on behalf of a man, a soldier, who we claim was left behind. Now, what happened just about the summer of 1953 was the negotiations and the armistice, of course, were going back and forth, and largely they were being sort of obstructed and had been obstructed for the course of 3 years. I mean, the negotiations for the armistice actually first began in December of 1950, if you can believe it.
Wow.
And Sigmund Rhee was had his mindset essentially on unifying all of Korea. And Kim Il-sung also, had his mindset on unifying Korea, which obviously is what precipitated the war, when he invaded South Korea on June 25th, 1950. So Sigmund Rhee, at every turn he attempted to sort of influence events in such a way that the armistice didn't get signed until July of 1953. I'm not laying it all on Sigmund Rhee. Obviously, the North mm-hmm. Koreans were a handful, especially when they were backed by the Chinese. I think the Chinese were at the table. But at that point, in that summer, of course, one of the big issues on the table was the repatriation of POWs. The UN, command held most of the POWs. I mean, they probably had 100,000 North Koreans and Chinese. And what many of them didn't want to do was to repatriate back to North Korea, if you can believe it.
We can understand that. Let me just jump in here for our listeners. You know, if you've got a question that you'd like to ask Joe or a comment here on this program today, give us a call at 877-573-7825. That's 877-573-7825. This theme of not wanting to go back north, has run into a couple of our conflicts that we've been involved in. I mean, it was a similar situation in Vietnam.
Right.
Yeah. The prisoners that we had down there, they didn't want to go back north.
Yeah. And, of course, the North Koreans were insistent. And so, to make a long story short, there eventually came a prisoner exchange. And it was sometime after the war, probably about, maybe 3 or 4 years later, there was a congressional resolution that was passed that pretty much acknowledged the fact that there were about 450 POWs that were unaccounted for. And most Americans didn't know that, and life went on. And sometime in the mid-70s, a fellow by the name of Robert Dumas had a brother that went missing during the Korean War. And his basically the letter they got from the Army said something to the effect that he was MIA, and that basically is the position or the condition or the status that they maintained after the war for some time. And then in the normal course of things, the Army sends a letter that says, inasmuch as we haven't heard anything from Mr. Dumas or Private Dumas, we'll declare him dead. So not being satisfied with that, Bob Dumas went to the archives in the 70s and began to look through the archives, and lo and behold, he finds basically a report that had been declassified that said something to the effect that Roger had been actually a POW. And so he asked the Army to explain themselves, and of course they brushed him off. He went back again, and he found the next year, he found the International Red Cross report. That essentially had the names of several individuals who claimed they had spotted him. And then he had found, finally, another report to the effect that there were three soldiers that identified Roger as being a POW. So with all that in hand, he went and asked the Army for a reclassification. And you seek reclassification to the Army Board for Correction Military Records. When they denied that in the early 80s, he had no recourse but to sue. And so he asked me to handle the case for him, which I did. And so for the next several years, we prosecuted our case until it came to trial. And in the end, we were able to find a soldier because, many of these guys, even by then, weren't doing well in their terms of health. A couple of them disappeared mysteriously. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on in the background.
Yeah, there was a lot of I don't know, spy stuff, it sounded like, almost, and
well, there
Big
was.
Brother and all kinds of things going on here.
Yeah, because as soon as somebody, tried to raise these issues, they were visited, by CID or they were visited by CIA. And I'm not telling stories out of school. I mean, this is the actual truth.
Mm-hmm.
And so, when you try to raise a particular question or see a particular document, suddenly there was a state secret order put on it, and it was only visible by the judge, and we couldn't see it. And so in the end, we did find ourselves an eyewitness to our missing soldier who was in Camp 5. And the story that he tells, the real story, which I essentially tell again in the novel, is absolutely compelling. He says something to the effect, I'm just going to read it real quick because this is the actual transcript from the court case. And this fellow is, if you can imagine who he is, he's a Southern guy from Georgia. And he was a first sergeant in his career. He had been a career man, career soldier, served in the Second World War and also served in Korea. And he says something like this. He says, one day we were stacking bodies up there to get back to your question, and there was a man laying in the room right next to the death room. Most of these Korean shanties, they had two what you call living rooms. And the comment was made by one of the guys who was helping with these bodies. I guess he'll be one of the ones tomorrow. And he said, what's wrong with that man? He said, he's been wounded, I said. Well, can't they do anything for him? And he said, no. And I walked and looked in at the man, and he had a large wound on his left side. The wound had already turned black and was beginning to rot. It was stinking, and the man was running a fever. And so far as I could determine, he was in a coma. And I said, is there anything else wrong with him? And they said, no, just that wound there. Well, I'm not a doctor, and I have never had any professional medical training, but I do read a lot, and I do remember some of the old home remedies we used down in Georgia. And he goes on, and he says what he did essentially is, he says, and I went to the latrine and scooped out a handful of feces with maggots, and I rinsed the feces over the maggots and took it to a place and placed it in the body in the boy's side. I took a rag and tied it as best I could. I felt I couldn't hurt him because he was too near, almost dead. I figured that day he probably would have gone ahead and died. So later on, he sees this kid about 4 or 5 months later on the Yalu taking a bath. And he walks up to him and he taps him on the back and he says, remember me? And the kid says, no, I don't. And he says, well, I'm the guy, you know, basically that helped bring you back. And the guy at the in the river taking a bath had a T-shirt, and on the back of it, he had the name Dumas, which is the very guy we were looking for. And so he was able to identify him in court as actually having been in prison. So the question was, at that point, there was no question that our man was there. Now the question was, well, why did the government not, you know, concede that fact? Why did we have this very expensive trial, which took 3 years in court and, you know, a battery of lawyers on both sides to fight over the fact that this was a known fact?
This is a fascinating story, and I want to remind our audience we're talking with Joe Carvalho. He's the author of We Were Beautiful Once, Chapters from a Cold War, which is the fictionalized version of this court case that he's talking about. And there was also a documentary that was made talking about this particular story. Isn't that correct?
That's right. Yeah, and Ed Asner, I guess, was the commentator on it, or the,
Right, and I would encourage our audience, if this is an issue that really, you know, that you want to get solved, is to go check out not only this book, of course, but also the documentary. I think it's called Missing, Presumed Dead.
That's it, yeah.
The Search for America's POWs, and it's online, it's free, and you can watch it on your computer. It just was, I was riveted to the screen when I'm watching this, and that story that you just read from your transcript, the guy is actually there talking about it.
Yeah.
And then you took this same character and kind of filled him in a little bit more and put him in the book.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the theme of the book, aside from the central idea here of trying to locate the POW, there's a couple of other things that other parts of the mystery that came together had to come together. One was what actually happened, you know, to Roger. Mm-hmm. And about 2 years after this court case, I happened to be at a ABA NSA meeting, if you can believe it, in Stanford, Connecticut.
Could you tell us what those letters mean?
Oh, National Security Agency and the American Bar Association. They had a
kind of an unusual relationship.
Exactly, an unusual relationship. But I was invited by a professor who was of mine in law school, who was actually of Chinese extraction, and he knew that I was involved in this case, and I'd been to Korea, and so he was keep me informed as to, you know, what was happening on the Asian front with respect to the ABA. And I attended the meeting, and the speaker was U. Alexis Johnson. And U. Alexis Johnson is a really interesting character. He's he's dead now, but he was an ambassador for the United States. And in his the build-up that the host was giving us that night, he said U. Alexis Johnson had been, you know, a negotiator in Vietnam and Paris, I guess, along with Kissinger. And he also was in the room with John F. Kennedy in the Cuban Missile Crisis, advising Kennedy. And he was also one of the negotiators at Panmunjom. And you know, okay. So that really piqued my attention. Well, after he spoke, he basically bid everybody farewell. He had to get back to Washington. Everyone was having their pie and coffee. And I bolted to the lobby to head him off. And I said, you know, Ambassador Johnson, my name is so-and-so. He's waiting for his car, of course. And I explained to him who I was and what I did in the course of about a minute and a half, two. And I asked him, I says, what happened, you know, to those young men? He says, it was an awful thing we did, leaving them behind. And I was stunned. My jaw just opened wide because no one in the government or knew what was going on was ever that direct. And when I was about to sort of get into my next question, his car came, and that was the end of it. And I was involved in those days, you know, with the case, and I'd been dabbling in state politics, and I knew my congressman, Bill Ratchford, pretty well. And I asked him if he wouldn't please, you know, go back and see if we couldn't open this thing up. And to make a long story short, about 6 weeks later, they came back and said, well, we talked to you, Alexis Johnson. He doesn't remember having a conversation at the Marriott Inn in Stamford with anybody, and that was, you know, case closed. If you look at the history real quick, that was occurring just about the time the armistice was signed. General Mark Clark, Sigmund Rhee, had let the gate open in I think three different prison camps around Seoul. And about 10,000 North Koreans disappeared into the population. Mark Clark was up in arms and everybody else, but the point of fact was that it looked like it was going to scuttle the negotiations for the armistice. And the only thing that I could think of is that the North Koreans, being what they are, just held back some number of POWs in spite, as a matter of spite. But that's my own, you know, take on it. I have no evidence that that happened, but I do have evidence that we did leave POWs behind.
We have talked to a number of Korean veterans and a couple of Korean POWs on Veterans Radio, and they would probably confirm your story there about, mm-hmm. you know, and especially your description of the conditions at Camp 5 were almost verbatim from a conversation that we had with them.
Yeah,
a gentleman even lives in the local area, and
they
were just horrendous,
awful.
And I don't think most of us could even comprehend the idea of stacking dead bodies outside the door of our house until everything defrosted in the spring.
That's right, until it thawed. Yep.
And you know, just the idea of the, you know, using the maggots to help somebody because there wasn't any medical care there at all.
That's right. That's right.
And I think we have to really admire these survivors of the Korean conflict, for lack of a better term, there, and especially the POWs. These guys really, really suffered.
Yeah, exactly.
And then unfortunately they were forgotten.
Well, you know, in a way, the theme of my book is that there's a larger question, and the question is that when we go to war, the general population, you know, is aware of it. You know, we can talk about Vietnam or Iraq or Afghanistan while it's happening, but you know what? Wars play out over the next four generations, and that's what the story's about. The story's about a group of five, you know, people, three of whom went to war, two were women, they stayed behind, and then they came back, and it basically tracks their life through the 50s, 60s, 70s, and how the war affected them one way or another, either because of the loss or because they had PTSD or because of guilt. You know, there's a lot of things that happen in these days and these times. And so what I try to do is to try to sort of bring some realism through families that have to now work their way through issues that, frankly, they'll probably die with because of the effect the war had on them, even if they weren't in the war.
No, that's true. And I think it's great that everybody's finally paying attention to the after effects that it's going to have on these men and women that are coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan and their families.
That's right.
You know, I didn't realize, you know, the problems and issues I caused for my own family when I got home until many, many years later. And they said, boy, you were really this or you were that. And I said, I was. I'd have no recollection of doing those things. And they said, yeah, well, you weren't very nice. And, you know, you have to end up kind of going back and apologizing to people, you know, 20, 30 years ago. We're talking here. I can't get down to that. We're talking with Joe Carvalho here. The author of his book is We Were Beautiful Once, Chapters from a Cold War. And I love the idea that you took these characters from their hometown. They were all high school buddies and girlfriends and so forth.
Yeah.
And follow them not only through their military careers, but afterward. And you see all the ramifications of what we do sometimes when we're younger that come back later on.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, my father was in the Second World War, and I was a kid in diapers, I guess, through the kindergarten by the time he came back home. And I had about 10, you know, relatives in the Second World War, cousins and uncles. And one of the cousins ended up living with us, and in the middle of the night, he would start putting his fist through the wall, and it was either the wall was going to collapse or his fist was going to break. But, you know, he was challenged after the war and for many, many years. And then when I was in the service between 59 and 64, I was in SAC, we had guys that actually were over in Korea. These guys were gunners, and I was in a sort of a fire control area myself. And so I got to know these guys. So what I tried to do is not only build in the authenticity in so far as the military part of this is concerned and the case is concerned, but also in terms of the people's emotions and how, again, they reacted and changed their, you know, changed them as a consequence of their experiences in war.
Well, it's a great story, and I really encourage people to go out and get this book. By the way, where can they get it?
They can get it on Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble. Just type in my name, Carvalko, and this book will come up, and there'll be a couple of other books. This particular one, We Were Beautiful Once, is the latest novel. A couple of years ago, there was another book which actually has part of the transcript, which is A Road Once Traveled, which is the sort of the real trial. The actual court case. So,
all right. So The Road Once Traveled, Life from All Sides.
That's it. Yeah.
There. And We Were Beautiful Once with Joe Carvalho. What are you working on next, Joe?
Well, I'm doing. I'm going to be probably doing, of all things, if you can imagine, some science fiction. So. So, I'll be looking far ahead instead of looking back.
That's all right. You mentioned that you were in the service yourself?
Yeah, I was in from 59. I was in for about 5 years in the Air Force. And, you always have these mixed emotions about the service. You know, in some ways, I would not have traded that experience for all the tea in China, but it's really a shame we have to have, in a way, those kinds of experiences. So, you know, as I say, it's a mixed emotion.
It is a mixed emotion, and you talk about that a little bit in the book itself about the conflict of being in the military and actually having to go to war and then the aftermath of it and how come we have to go to war in the first place.
That's right. Yeah.
And this sort of I don't know, this DNA that's built into the human species.
I think you're right. It's too bad we couldn't channel more of this into sort of, you know, I don't want to say Peace Corps, but some kind of public service, you know, where the young people get the experiences of these, of working together, I guess, and the camaraderie and the fact that they can look back on it later in life and say, you know, that was a real learning experience. I'm not high enough up yet.
Yeah, that's for sure. But, you know, we all aren't up there, you know, we got about a minute and a half left, Joe. Is there what message would you like to leave with our audience about the book?
I think for those folks, you know, who are interested in stories like, not only war stories, but stories, there was some that came out of the Second World War. All My Children, for instance, that came out of the Second World War, which really talks about the tragedy of loss and how it affects the lives for so many years. Mm-hmm. People who like to read about courtrooms and mysteries, though this story, I guess this novel also, you know, covers that sort of genre as well. It's probably, I would think, satisfying on a couple of different levels. But certainly people who are interested in military, interested in veterans, I think it certainly should be an attraction.
It should be. And I think also those people that kind of believe in conspiracies would be very interested in reading this.
Right.
You know, so we have a wide audience here. Well, Joe Carvalho, I want to thank you so very much for being on Veterans Radio. I encourage people to go out and get this book, We Were Beautiful Once, Chapters from a Cold War, and I'd like to invite you back on sometime when we do another story about the Korean POWs.
Okay, Dale. Well, thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure. And I encourage people to go out and get the book. When we come back after the break, we're going to have Mike Jones and Michael Jones II or Junior. I don't know for sure, but we're going to be talking to the Air Force's newest second lieutenant. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be back after these messages.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Private First Class Melvin Brown, out of ammunition, used his entrenching tool to defend his position. Details after this.
There's always a moment of truth where I say, look, it's either put up or shut up. And it was time to put up. I had crossed that thin line. It was 100 plus degrees. We were hot. We were on fire. We were yelling our hearts out. You could feel the intensity rising. Even in our tiredness, even in our weakness, even in our pain, we continued to push. I told myself, you can suck up the pain for another mile and a half, and you will be a Marine. Not many people believe that I could do it. I don't know where I got the energy from. I don't know where the pain went to. But all I know is that I had what it took. I am a United States Marine.
AFC Darrell Willis proved he could be one of us. Can you? Call 1-800-MARINES. Maybe you could be one of the few and the proud.
While his platoon was securing Hill 755, the North Koreans counterattacked. Taking a position on a 50-foot-high wall, Brown delivered heavy rifle fire on the enemy. His ammunition was soon expended, and although wounded, he remained at his post and threw his few grenades. When his supply of grenades was exhausted, his comrades from nearby foxholes tossed others to him, and he left his position, braving a hail of fire, to retrieve and throw them at the enemy. The attackers continued their assault, and Brown, weaponless, drew his entrenching tool from his pack and calmly waited until they peered over the wall, delivering each a crushing blow on the head. Brown's daring action so inspired his platoon that they repelled the attack and held their position. Brown was reported killed in action September 5, 1950.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
You're listening to WDEO 990 AM, part of the Ave Maria Network.
And we are back on Veterans Radio, and it is our privilege today to talk to one of the newest graduates of the United States Air Force Academy. And this is kind of a family affair that's going on today, and we want to know if you have a question for our guest, give us a call here at Veterans Radio at 877-573-7825, 877-573-7825. For the last number of years that we've been here on WDEO, the program manager, Mike Jones, Michael Jones. Michael, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, welcome. Thank you very much. I'm just so honored to be here with you guys.
Well, it is our privilege. We have been talking for a number of years about how proud you were of the young man that's sitting to your right here because he was going to the Air Force Academy.
You know what? Can I interject something, though? I understand that Mike and his wife bought a whole bunch of stock in Men's Warehouse clothing because they had to keep replacing the vest. The buttons were popping off, man. Every time I saw him, he had to have new vests. I mean, it was just wonderful. He was just so proud.
Well, he has reason to be proud. Because, anyway, you were talking to us about the Air Force Academy, and I kept seeing the pictures on the wall and all these other things, and we said, you know, we've got to get Mike on, Mike Jr. on. I hate to say that, but anyway, we've got to get him on to talk about it. Well, we've got him on here now. Second Lieutenant Michael P. Jones, Jr., welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you so much. Again, I'm also honored to be here.
Well, thank you, and I got a couple of questions about the Air Force Academy, and I guess the first one was, how did you end up going there?
I guess when I was in high school, looking for different college options and different, you know, career path options, I wanted to join the military, but I also wanted to to go to college and get that education as well. And a service academy really combined both of those worlds.
And so the Air Force came up with the best deal?
Yeah, the Air Force came up with the best deal. And I liked the opportunities that the Air Force had post-graduation, you know, lots of different career fields available, from pilot and more operational career fields to, you know, the contracting, engineering, which I ended up in as an engineer now. So I liked having those options available.
Tell me a little bit about the Air Force Academy itself. You know, we've all heard rumors and stories about when you arrive on the on campus, how you're just welcomed with open arms.
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, there's you come in June, late June, for a six-week basic training. And that's basic training done in-house at the academy. It's conducted by the upperclassmen. So the
that's always fun.
Oh, so much fun! Yeah, the rising junior and senior class show you around for 6 weeks and take you through the ropes of Air Force basic training. That includes, you know, all the components that you would find in for example at Lackland, the dress and marching and military appearance stuff, as well as out in the field, you know, getting dirty and living in tents and all the physical training that goes along with all of that as well. And so that falls right into the academic year in August, and you go through a four-year academic program and end up graduating with a Bachelor of Science.
And you, when you were going there, tell our audience where the Air Force Academy is.
Certainly, yeah. It's Colorado Springs, Colorado. So right down that I-25 corridor in beautiful mountains of Colorado, up on the Front Range, up at 7,258 feet above sea level.
That was probably one of the things you had to memorize as soon
indeed
as you got
it was.
There.
Indeed it was.
All that really important information.
Exactly. Like the range of the fighters and bombers in the inventory and the names of various distinguished graduates, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a great opportunity for you know, men and women today to go to the Air Force Academy and to all the other academies also. We were talking to a number of guests a couple of weeks ago that were ended up being pilots in the Air Force. They had gone to the to West Point, and at that time they had the option of going into different services once they graduated. And one had gone to the Marines, and one had actually gone into the Navy, and one had gone into the Air Force before the Air Force Academy was founded.
Yeah.
And I'm going to stump you. When was the Air Force Academy founded?
Well, the first class graduated in 1959.
Okey-doke.
So they came in 55. And, they didn't move down. They were up at Lowry Air Force Base for a couple of years before campus was built down in Colorado Springs.
Now, does not everybody that goes to the Air Force Academy comes out being a pilot?
No. Typically about half the class will end up being pilots. So we graduate around 1,000 new second lieutenants every year. About 500 or so end up pilots, and then the rest will end up in, you know, the various other Air Force career fields.
Mm-hmm. Well, for our audience out there, if you have a question, you can give us a call here at 877-573-7825, or if you want to congratulate our new second lieutenant, that's fine. Give us a call on air. Also, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and that's due to the lovely Maria in the control room who is keeping everybody listening out there, what's going on the program. And so you can go there to facebook.com/veteransradio, or just go to Twitter and type in Veterans Radio and give us a comment and so forth. And we've actually got somebody following that. Bob and I are a little bit prehistoric, I guess, when it comes to using social media. As my wife always says, she's on phone book. And so,
yeah, right.
We're trying. But anyway, I'm going to go back to Mike Sr. here. How did you feel about all of this, about this young man going off to the academy?
Well,
during the time period that he was going there.
Oh, absolutely. Actually, it was We're proud from the very beginning. My father and my father-in-law both were World War II vets. I have a brother-in-law who was a Navy Ordnance Disposal Officer, a Master Sergeant, I guess, a nephew in the Air Force at the time. I have two boys, two girls. Both of them went through Scouts. One of the opportunities during the Scouts opportunity was we went out to Annapolis and had a Scout Jamboree, kind of a merit badge weekend a couple of times, and the boys both got very interested in Annapolis at the time. And when go through the application process, there's lots of discernment available, lots of time to think about it. One of the things that a parent might like is that our tax dollars, of course, which I pay plenty of, go into funding all of these young men and women, and they get a job when they're done with college, you know.
That's true.
And that job is an important job. So the opportunity to serve is a great thing, and we're just very proud that the boys both had that that desire to serve. So
you have a brother?
Yeah, I have a younger brother.
He's not involved in the military. You know,
just get closer to the microphone a little bit there.
Yeah, he actually wishes he could have gone, but he has celiac disease, and you cannot you're not deployable if you can't have gluten. So so Patrick missed out on an opportunity to join as well.
Okay. So you were active in Boy Scouts also?
Yes, I was.
Did you make it to the top?
I am an Eagle Scout, yes.
Well, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Quite make it that far. I got to life.
Oh, I was only second class, and then I left.
I got to life, and then got into Explorers and found women.
Oh, there you go. That changes things.
Got a distraction off to the
careful
side.
Yeah, incoming.
But what is the process to get into these academies? I mean, we've got a lot of people out there listening that probably have children and have grandchildren that might want to go to the to one of these academies. What is the process they have to go through?
Well, part of it like a normal college application process with the transcripts and the SAT or ACT scores and the essay. And then there's other parts as well, including, your full DOD physical, making sure you are commissionable. And then to actually receive an appointment at one of the academies, you have to be nominated, typically by your senator or your congressman. So every senator and congressman in the state will have some sort of application process to them, and they'll usually go through a round of interviews, and so they can choose their nominees, and they all have a certain number that they get to fill and a certain number of slots every year. So those come, again, typically from your senator or your local congressman, but also from the president, presidential nominations for children of current service members.
Okay. And who did you go through?
I got a nomination from my local congressman.
And who was that?
Yeah, Tim Walberg.
Okay.
Honorable Tim Walberg.
He's still out there.
Yeah, he's still out there.
He's still a representative of my district, yeah.
All right. Well, that's kind of cool. You mentioned before that when you got out to the Air Force Academy that you had to go through sort of a mini basic training and harassment time period. What did you think, and we've got about 2 minutes that we're going to take a break. What was the most difficult part of your training, do you think?
I think it came after that basic. During freshman year, there's still a lot of, disciplines that are imposed on you. And you have to combine that. Sort of a relaxed version of basic that continues throughout freshman year. If you combine that with all of your academic studies and staying on top of that in addition to whatever extracurriculars you might take on. And I think the discipline that I had to learn during freshman year in order to manage all those different draws on my time was probably the most the steepest learning curve.
I think in my experience, it was also the same thing. I mean, even though I didn't go to the academies, it's just going through basic training. And then when I went to flight school, we had a 4-week condensed officer training program so that we wouldn't be completely, negligent in how do we salute and do all these other different things. And, we had to memorize what at the time I thought was useless information, but as I look back on it, I still remember it. So it must have accomplished its mission there. But you have to become so disciplined because once you get out and you get yourself into a military situation, you can't stop and think and wonder, oh, my gosh, what am I going to do when this situation comes up? You just have to react to it. Yeah. And I think that's what they're trying to teach everybody as we go along. We're going to take a break here right now. So, Robert, if you are ready over there, and I know I'm not your mother, but I'm still going to call you Robert. We're talking with Mike Jones and Lieutenant Mike Jones here on Veterans Radio, and we'll be right back after these messages.
For the past 100 years, Amish furniture craftsmen have placed great value upon the beauty and quality of their work, with great attention paid to the details of the wood. Each board is then hand-selected to match the specific furniture in mind and in achieving the desired look of the finished piece. At Naked Furniture of Ann Arbor Showroom, you will find displays of this fine craftsmanship that you can afford and own. Now is the time. You can visit Naked Furniture at 3570 Washtenaw Avenue and experience this fine quality for yourself. The furniture consultants at Naked Furniture of Ann Arbor are there to show you the fine details of Amish furniture. See for yourself the fine quality Amish furniture. Go to Naked Furniture of Ann Arbor, 3570 Washtenaw Avenue, or visit their website, nakedfurnitureofannarbor.com.
And in the history of America's military, that's probably a good song, starting out in the 1770s and moving on now into the 2010s.
But you know, I have followed this. I wish I were in the other studio. I have followed this. I'm looking at Mr. Jones right now. He knows how many weeks, months, updates, Mike. Welcome home, and I think you are a Yankee Doodle Dandy to this entire country. And may I ask you one question? I wasn't sure because I was fooling around here in the board. What exactly was your, I guess, would you call it a degree or your MOS? Or it was nuclear or something?
No, I got a degree in astronautical engineering. So it's a Bachelor of Science that you graduate with. And, in fact, it's interesting that everyone graduates with the Bachelor of Science degree, even if you major in English or
okay. You could go to the Air Force and major in English?
You can, believe it or not. But the core curriculum is so heavy on engineering, math, science, that you fulfill the requirements for the Bachelor of Science degree. Mm-hmm. No matter what your major is.
And I hear that you're going to MIT. Mike, you're going to have to buy more stock in men's warehouse.
Yeah, on graduation, so in the fall here, I'm going to spend 2 years at MIT getting a master's in the same field in space systems engineering.
Okay.
And then I'll be, MOS-wise, I'll be a engineer for the Air Force working on satellites.
Well, I'm going to sign off here and continue to set up for the close. So I just want to say God bless you, Mike and Mike, the Mike and Mikes. God bless you both, and you are an honor to have you on this program and to be part of our country's military. God bless you.
Thank you, Bob.
Stealing all my thunder here. I don't know what I'm going to do. Thunder over Michigan. No, that's right. That's coming up in August. Did you have aspirations at one time to be like an astronaut, or is that something that crossed your mind?
That process, that actually most typically comes from the pilot community. So mm-hmm. people go to pilot training and then end up at like a test pilot school, and then make their applications into NASA rather than from the engineering community. Yeah, this is probably not a good path to be on if that was my goal. So,
okay, and you're as you said, your degree is a Bachelor of Science.
Yes,
and repeat that degree.
Astronautical engineering.
Astronautical.
Yes.
Oh, right. We're around smart people here. Isn't it great when our kids are so smart?
It is. Yes, it is indeed. I guess astro is above the atmosphere, and aero is below the atmosphere. Is that how you think about it?
Sure. As most colleges, for undergrad at least, will combine the two into an aerospace engineering degree. Mm-hmm. But USAFA actually breaks them down into aeronautical engineering and astronautical engineering as separate. So the the part where there's air involved and mm-hmm. the part up in
there's
orbit.
There's no air. All right. Let's go back to your last 4 years. And before sure. I got your bio from your dad, I went on to the Air Force Academy's website, and I found this graduation thing. And I can't remember the name of the squadron that you were in, but everybody was broken down in all these different squadrons.
Yep. There's so about 1,000 cadets in each class. It's a 4-year program. That's 4,000 total in the cadet wing at any given time. And they're broken down, those 4,000, into 4 groups of 1,000 and 10 squadrons per group. So each of the 40 total cadet squadrons has about 100 cadets in it. And I was in as a proud graduate of Cadet Squadron 12, the Dirty Dozen.
The Dirty Dozen, okay.
Right.
Everybody had a little motto there.
That's right.
I noticed that. And one of the things, that, I don't know if this still goes on, but if there's trouble within your squadron, let's suppose that somebody does something they're not supposed to do, does the whole squadron have to pay for that?
At times, yeah. At times, the whole cadet wing has to has to pay. But there's also, you know, individual discipline within the squadron. That mm-hmm. So a lot of stuff actually gets to be handled on the squadron level, discipline-wise. So the cadet squadron commander, who's a senior, takes care of in-house a lot of the local discipline.
You ended up, what were your command responsibilities by the time you got done there?
Sure. Last fall, and they change semester by semester, but last fall, the first semester of my senior year, I was a cadet group commander. So I was in charge of cadet group 2, that's squadrons 11 through 20. And that was an amazing opportunity for me to be able to see what goes into, you know, the leading a group of 1,000 people. And,
mm-hmm.
and so I was working for not only had the cadet chain of command where I was working for the cadet wing commander, but I was also working with the lieutenant colonel who was in charge of that group from the, we call it permanent party side, the officer side,
mm-hmm.
That supervises us. And so it's a good opportunity to see him professionally working for his group of 1,000 people and then me getting to do what I could on the cadet-run side of the house.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating when you think about the responsibility that you had at 21 years old and, you know, how many, you know, 1,000 people were answered to you.
Yeah, it was, I kind of joke around that, you know, I won't be so cool again for a long time, you know. I had 1,000 people and now I'm a lowly second lieutenant, so.
Well, I can imagine what that's going to look like on his resume, though, someday, if you decide not to stay in, you know, the mm-hmm. Air Force for the, even if you do stay in for 20 years and you get out and say, you know, have you ever, you know, had control of a group of people? Well, yeah, it was 1,000 guys, but, you know, and women that, you know, I was responsible for that they yeah. had, you know, and all these other things. I think that's cool. I'm going to ask a question here about pay. Now, everybody thinks, well, you know, these guys have spent, you know, they get a free education and then they get to go out and get a job. But what is the starting salary now for a second lieutenant?
For a second lieutenant is base salary about $2,200 a month. And then you make, on top of that, your BAH, you know, your housing allowance,
okay.
and then your food allowance. And then, of course, you know, the pilot guys will get their
flight pay and stuff. So we're looking at what, about $3,000 a month, maybe?
Yeah, I think I'm actually living in an expensive area. I'm going to be getting about $5,000 a month because of that,
wow.
that nice big housing allowance.
There you go.
Yeah,
because yeah, you're going to become a Yankee Doodle Dandy. I you're going to be going to MIT. So it's not for the money that you do this.
No, not really. Especially, you know, not as a cadet, especially. You get cadet pay is set at one-third of a second lieutenant's pay with no seniority, no housing allowance, none of that. So you
did get a little stipend.
You get a
little
stipend, yeah. It's enough to cover books and, you know, make sure you're not, you know, you can go out on the weekends every once in a while and have a good time.
And where did they go in Colorado? Gee, that's a tough place. I think let's go skiing this weekend.
Right? Yeah, no, that's I got to ski a good amount. So that was a blast. Colorado's a beautiful state. So much stuff mm-hmm. to do in the outdoors. You're right there in the mountains. So never short of fun things to do in our free time.
It sounds great. Mike, talking to the dad now, did you go to the graduation?
Absolutely. This is a once-in-a-lifetime.
Tell me what you felt about that.
Well, you begin with, you know, the various – there's events for 3 or 4 days. And throughout those events, you get to see the wing at its very best. We got to meet the commandant. Is that the correct term?
Right? Yeah.
For General Gould?
Yes. Gould is the superintendent.
Superintendent. Okay. Yeah. So we got
Gould.
To meet.
A Gould is a superintendent? Right. It must be related.
Three stars there,
three
Bob.
Three star, Bob. You got a general related to you you don't even know about.
And
is he rich?
Well,
he's a three-star general. Come on.
He doesn't have to be personally rich, but he gets to use the riches of his office.
That's true.
Never heard of the guy.
And of course, throughout the entire week, there is various group and squadron awards. There are school awards. There are demonstrations, parades. Everything from the little Peregrine Falcons flying around the stadium to flyovers by, in this year, World War II craft flew over. The graduation itself was quite an amazing event. The discipline showed there's probably 20,000 people in the stands. Mm-hmm. It's just a proud day when your son or daughter can walk across that stage and receive their first salute from an enlisted man and their first salute from an officer, and to receive a degree of this magnitude from this kind of rigorous academic academy from the Secretary of the Air Force. You know, so it was great experiences for the parents.
Hanging around with the grown-ups.
Yeah, exactly.
Hanging around the grown-ups. I like the concept. Here's a question for you. When you got, after you graduated and got your bars, I'm assuming that, you know, your mom probably put your bars, pinned your bars on.
Yes, she did.
Something like that. Who was the first person to salute you?
That was my Academy Military Trainer, Master Sergeant Ben Ireland.
And so what did you have to give him for that?
A silver dollar.
Hasn't changed a bit.
That's right.
It
hasn't changed a bit.
And I got my bars and my wings, and the first guy outside the door, like, you know, like this.
Yeah, yes, right.
Saluting everybody with his hand out. Sir, you know, because now you outrank him, of course.
That's right.
Which is a really unusual thing, because you keep... You know, I kept calling him sir or sergeant, whatever his name happened to be. And I was telling Bob earlier when I was going to be introduced to you, I have to call you sir. You outranked me.
Well, no, you were an officer.
No, I was only a warrant officer. I was nothing compared to lieutenants and all the others.
You, sir, you flew helicopters, sir.
I did.
You deserve the word sir. Every time someone sees you, you deserve a sir.
We're called chief.
Yeah, okay. Very good, chief.
Which is kind of cool. Well, you know, I think this has been a great opportunity to find out how – you know, the military keeps growing, all of their officers and all of their leaders. And I think that most of us at the bottom, especially people lower down, we don't understand the training that you have to go through and, you know, and how important it is that we do this with our officers so that we have the finest leadership for the finest men and women that are serving at the lower ranks. And I want to thank you both for being on Veterans Radio today.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for having us.
And I wish you the best of luck. And thank you for serving the country. And I think as I wrote in the flyer, I said something about the next generation of America's finest. So, Mike Jr., thank you very much for being on Veterans. Mike, it's our pleasure always
to have
you on the program. Bob, we got some stuff coming up next week. Just a reminder to our audience, don't forget the Thunder over Michigan, please. August 10th and 11th, there's going to be some great planes and some great reenactments, and you're going to run into a lot of pilots, a lot of Air Force guys all over the place. So until next week, you are dismissed.
The opinions or views expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or WDEO. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.